dear listener, and welcome back at last to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who actually did order the champagne. And we're drinking it now. I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
I'm Brendan.
And I'm here too.
So we've been off the air for nearly 10 years now, so we're all well rested and raring to commit some fairly major acts of domestic terrorism at tea time on BBC One. That's right, it's the first episode of the new series, Rose.
Well, I did. Did you?
Oh, absolutely.
I always rise to the occasion.
Yeah, there's not a major department store in London still standing as we speak.
I'm still in shock from this story, and I'm talking about seeing it in 2000. When did we see it?
Six, yeah, 2005. Yeah.
In Australia.
It was a very long time.
Very long time ago. I was just sitting here relieved, thinking, oh, at least this will be a really short run for FTE because it's only been going a short time. It hasn't, has it?
No.
We're actually up to where Liz is almost about to take a stuffed owl and tell him where to put his aspidistra, isn't she?
In terms of real time.
Yeah, yes, in real time.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Just as well that everyone agrees that the show is entirely lovely and that there's no controversy with any production staff for the entire 13 years run, so it'll be very smooth.
It has been very, very peaceful, but that's mostly because all the people involved are still alive. And we can't bitch about them behind their backs. Can we talk about the new series?
Can we?
I think we can.
Yeah. So I remember, and my Doctor Who The Complete History is telling me that the new series was announced.
I'm plumbing for 2003.
Yeah, that would be my guess as well.
Wednesday, September 24th.
2003.
Where were you sitting, Todd? And was it comfortable?
My memory cheats. I thought it was 2004, but yeah.
I was sitting at work. I remember absolutely being naughty looking at the interweb in 2003, which you had to do through your workstation so everyone knew what you were doing, but nobody actually was that skilled to be able to see what you were doing. And it came up, Eccles Cakes was going to be the new Doctor, and I thought, that'll be a really lovely one-off special or maybe a couple, yes.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that it was going to kind of last as long as it did.
Didn't quite believe it. It was just a thing.
I think I was in denial because it had been off the air and we had the audio series with Big Finish was sort of what I assumed that we would have forever.
Yeah.
And, well, actually my first reaction was, well, that's it, we're stuffed, because I was organising another Doctor Who convention. And so it was going to be the last one of the team of the conventions that I'd been running for, like, you know, 7 or 8 years. And we were trying to get Peter Davison, and we had India Fisher, who was the Doctor Who girl in terms of audios, and we were trying to promote her. And I think we had Louise Jamison, and then Peter pulled out, and then Louise pulled out, and
Joss pulled hers out.
And I think Fraser Hayes came on board, so we had a black and white companion, an audio companion, and then this was announced, and I went, well, that's it. We're just...
Who's going to care?
Yeah, we're just stuffed. No, I didn't use that word. We're not going to get anybody because everybody would want somebody from the new series.
No, I remember that, and I, flashing forward, because I may not be here to discuss this, I remember, do you remember, Todd, you tried to get Annette Badland?
Well, she actually contacted us.
Oh, right.
And what she wanted as a guest star was more than what we'd ever paid for doctors.
Yeah.
I'm not free.
Which was, you know, which, fair enough, you know, it's a new time, a new century, you know, and I fully expected that, but it sort of made me go, okay, we're entering a brand new sort of era of things here, like in terms of conventions and stuff, and it's not going to be nice little intimate things anymore. It's going to change forever.
Try her now, see how much she is.
I think she's got a soap at the moment. I think she's on our telly all the time, unless I'm much mistaken.
She's been in EastEnders. Is it EastEnders? Yes, I think so.
So's Louise. You know, she wasn't the first.
And Bonnie.
Bonnie.
But absolutely. Recently. So, yeah. So that was my initial thing. Well, that's it.
Yeah. Wow.
Did we hear rumours about it beforehand?
There had been rumours since 2000. And it was always Russell's name attached to it. And Russell was talking to the BBC from 1999 after the success of Queer as Folk.
Yeah.
But the thing was, Russell thought the BBC weren't serious about it, which for some people led to a knock-on effect of, oh, I thought Russell T Davies really wanted to do Doctor Who, but he doesn't seem to. He's not returning calls, this, that, the other. There was also the problem that the rights still rested with BBC Films after the telly movie. And so there was a complicated rights situation there. Mark Gatiss and Gareth Roberts had pitched a 21 half-hour episode series made up of 7 3-part stories with their dream casting was Derek Jacobi as the Doctor. It was written about in Dwim a couple of years ago, and the one thing I really remember was sort of 2 or 3 stories in the episode cliffhanger would be UFO lands, a Dalek slides out, companion turns around, what is it, Doctor? And the Doctor says, I've no idea.
Yeah.
But that was their idea of the Time War. He'd forgotten it. Yeah, instead they were...
That would have been a zinger, wouldn't it?
They were constantly after Russell, but Jane Tranter, who became a champion of the series, when she finally cornered Russell and got him to agree to a meeting, suddenly went off on maternity leave. Right. So this is in 2002, so it doesn't come up until 2003. In terms of what I remember from the time, I remember the announcement because I was so excited for a little thing which was going to be the continuation of Doctor Who called Scream of the Shulker.
Oh.
So Scream of the Shulker was announced around, I think, June or July, and then the very next month it gets gazumped by Doctor Who is coming back to television. But
Isn't that a cartoon thing?
Yeah. With
Flash Animation, Paul Cornell.
Richard E. Grant
in Stephen Moffat, Inverness Cape.
Yes.
And massive blue mobile phone.
Mm-hmm. And
with which he does everything. And a fantastic companion.
Yeah, Oscar winner Sophie Okonedo.
Yes. Who is Liz Ten, isn't she?
Exactly.
In The Beast Below. And, of course, Derek Jacobi playing the Master, which is something I'm surprised they never thought to do again.
Yeah.
Amazing. It really is very good, except for the fact that it's not.
Yeah. And except for the fact that Richard E. Grant has no idea what Doctor Who is. He saw a Dalek once during a charity special.
But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to play a poor doctor, and this is probably where we lead into Eccles.
Mm.
Not being a non-wee can actually help. An actor should come to a part.
Yeah.
Freshly.
Yes. I saw the news on DoctorWhoNews.com, as is now Outpost Gallifrey back then, and they had to shut down the forum for a day just because people got so excited and so angry. Like, it must be 25-minute episodes. No, it must not be 25-minute episodes. And Jay Sean Lyon stepping in and saying, guys, we literally know nothing. Because at this point, the BBC didn't even know how many episodes they were going to make. Initially, they offered Russell 6. Russell countered with 8. Julie Gardner is then the one who came in and said, actually, here's the sums for 13.
Yeah. Bless Julie.
Oh, my goodness.
Going to be the patron saint of the podcast over the next 4 years, I think.
Can I give my stupid fanboy reaction, though? My stupid angry fanboy reaction something?
Please.
So a year after the initial announcement, on October 18 in 2004, they released the logo.
Yes. And my cat was doing it for several years beforehand on her side.
Yeah.
Yes.
Friend of the podcast.
I mean that in a nice, publishable way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Friend of the podcast, Blaine Coughlin of JCBC Films, actually sent me a picture of it because he was living back in the UK by that point. He's like, isn't this amazing? And I don't know what it was. It was a couple of days after my birthday, and I remember I was at work and I was still working at KFC, so maybe I was annoyed about that, but I hated it. I said it looked amateurish and cheap. I hated the font. I hated the background. I said it was a ripoff of Farscape. Yes, the typeface. Sorry, darling.
No, I just do that to annoy people.
By the time it rocked around, I quite liked it, but I was just really, really obstreperous on that day, and I just remember that.
Yeah. No one liked it, except for me, because it was new and shiny.
We thought it was unworthy of the diamond logo, frankly.
I was not impressed.
You didn't like it?
No.
I can't
say anything more than that. I didn't like it.
Mm. In retrospect, I think it is amazingly
it's sensational
good.
In retrospect.
Yeah. And it captures that London thing, which we're going to come back to over and over again during Russell's era. Because
it looks like a taxi sign.
Exactly.
It does, actually. Well, and the way that he's dressed, no, it really does. He is a delivery man. He's delivering us hope.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
That's awful. And chips.
So I worried that if it was 45-minute episodes, that the Doctor would be presented with things that were quite easy to solve. Do you know what I mean? And over the years, the Doctor's got better at solving things. You know, normally it used to take him 6 episodes and, you know, Pertwee sort of slowed down at the beginning. It would take him 7 episodes to solve something. And then eventually Sylvester McCoy came along and he would just solve something in 3 episodes. He was a genius. But now we'd have a Doctor who would solve things in 45 minutes. But I think in retrospect, it's the only possible choice that they could have made. You can't do that kind of thing where most people are tuning in on a Saturday night to watch a quarter of a story.
But that's the point. This would not have been this way if it wasn't Russell. This is more a Russell T. Davies piece of writing than it is a Doctor Who piece of writing. It is absolutely his way of approaching the world in his writing. It just happens to be that he's entirely soused in whoiness.
Yeah.
Well, he's not pitching it to fans. He's not. And in order to make a show a success, you should not be pitching to a small group of people. You are writing for yourself and you're writing for general public, and television's moved on by 2004. Yeah. And if we'd had 25-minute episodes, we would have had one series and that's it. And I remember at the time going, oh, 45-minute episodes, we're not going to get enough character sort of development. And you know, I do think there are some pacing issues at various times, but it's the right decision and it's television now.
Yeah. And as for character development, I mean, you get more character stuff in a 45-minute Doctor Who episode these days than you did in sort of entire early seasons, to be honest. Or there's a different approach to character development where it grows out of the actors' performances and very subtle things in the old series, but the new series is much more explicit and much more deliberate about it, I think.
I guess what I mean by character development is that the supporting characters or the guest stars, you know who Harrison Chase and Scorby are.
Yeah.
Will you get to know the villains or have a real understanding? Will they be just throw away every week and you don't really connect?
We don't get Greg and Petra back, do you know what I mean, who we get to know over the course of nearly 2 months.
So how was that going to pan out, you know?
One person who was a big proponent of the 45-minute structure, and I can't remember when she said it, so I might be getting ahead of myself, take a drink, dear listener, but Janet Fielding. Janet Fielding said the 45-minute structure was great because she said, you know, back when we were doing it in 25, it takes about 10 minutes for the audience to settle into the program. And so then you've only got 15 minutes of plot and exploration. Whereas with 45 minutes, 10 minutes to settle into the program, and then you've got 35 minutes to develop story and the characters. So she's like, even though the whole story takes less time, there's more time of the audience actually being engaged with the idea after the setup. And you know, then she complained about Billy Piper's hair for 10 minutes, but...
Well, what was she sticking her salary heart in for? but nothing to do with it.
I really do think if you look at so many classic Doctor Who stories now, like if you sat down and you actually scripted them as a modern-day television event, like a 6-episode story and look at the Pertwees, it would be completely differently structured and you'd write it. And I reckon that, you know, a 6-episode story would be maybe, you know, 50 to 60 minutes. You would actually get it down to that long. It's just a different – television's changed and the way stories are changed and the way television is produced and shot and audiences' attention spans, may I say it, or the way we look at things now is all different.
I mean, Stephen Moffat makes the point, I think, correctly that old Doctor Who does – consist of lots of people sort of standing urgently in corridors for long periods of time. Or
dinner with Andre action figure set is testament on my dusted bookshelves to just how gripping this concept could be. Bugger off. That is the history of small rep theatre.
Yeah.
People standing about saying horrible things have just happened over there behind the arras.
Yeah, but now we can afford to kind of be a visual spectacle in a way that Doctor Who did aim for and certainly hit.
Marco Polo. I'm so grateful we got in touch with that Queensland fan and got to catch up with that at Christmas. Didn't that blow you sideways?
Nice. Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that.
I just couldn't believe the scene with Mechagodzilla, you know. It totally wasn't in the script.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to the audio recording of that that sequence either.
Mm.
So did we get casting straight away when they announced it?
I think Eccles was right up at the front, and that's what got the momentum, wasn't it? Because Jane Tranter didn't push the button until they got Eccles.
Yeah, and Eccles himself actually contacted Russell. So, the announcement came, and I think casting came about a month later, but Eccleston contacted Russell because they worked together before on The Second Coming. Which is a drama where Christopher Eccleston plays Jesus.
Yeah. We'll actually talk about that in our Aliens of London episode because it shares a lot of elements with The Second Coming, in fact.
The thing is, what Christopher Eccleston says is he had seen a little bit of Doctor Who in the 70s growing up. He would later say in interviews, you know, you either watched Doctor Who or you went and played sport, and I was usually playing sport, but I did see some of it. But what he found was, everyone's so posh, there's no one like me on this show. But then he thought, this guy's always moving, he's never at home. And he sent an email to Russell saying that, because immediately the character fired his imagination. Like, how sad is this character? How lonely is this character? What's the dramatic potential? And then as a PS, he put, by the way, Russell, I might be interested in this role.
Wow.
Only to find that Russell had already shortlisted him. And completely unknown to him, he had been shortlisted for the telly movie.
Oh, okay.
No.
He was never contacted, but he had been shortlisted.
But then so was everybody.
Well, so was Peter Capaldi.
John Sessions and Stephen Moffat.
I was shortlisted. Yes.
Rick Mile.
Mm-hmm. Would have been good.
So Hugh Grant was the first offer for the role because the BBC could pretty much only put half the money in, so they needed international pre-sales. And possibly co-production money from elsewhere, which they eventually got from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, were a full co-producer for the first series, and possibly the second, but not beyond that. But Hugh Grant turned it down. He didn't want to be tied to a series, and he has said in recent years that he massively regrets it, and it would have been fantastic.
Have you seen that meme? What would it have been like had Hugh Grant taken on this role?
Lots of planets have a Sussex.
Have you seen those little GIFs there? Really telling. It's the second season of Cat Weasel without the jokes.
You humans, all you do is sit at home and drink beluga caviar.
The accent wouldn't have worked.
I'm doing it now.
I don't know whether the series Bible, which has been published, you know, Russell's original pitch document for the first series.
Rose Meets the Doctor.
Well,
with Muggsy and Judy.
Lola and Cliff.
Yeah, it's so TV comic. Yeah. But I was hoping for that as a reboot, frankly.
But he does say that he doesn't want the Doctor to be the neutered public schoolboy that he so often was in the past.
I've never known public schoolboys to be neutered in any manner.
No, but I think that's Hugh Grant's family motto, I think.
Neutered public schoolboy.
Perhaps they'd already decided to go into a sort of more working class direction with Eccleston in a way that they kind of not really touch on with McCoy, who at least doesn't have an RP accent. But
he just has a whole lot of rollickings, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, even the fact that northern accent needs to be lampshaded in this episode with Lots of Planets Have a North.
How do we feel about that?
I thought it was brilliant because it's taking the fact that people are going to say, oh, he doesn't sound like a proper Doctor Who, and it's providing an explanation while kind of saying the explanation doesn't matter.
Yeah, we don't care.
For the people who need to understand why there's a certain voice and we'll get a scene like this cut from the Christmas Invasion, they need some kind of explanation. For the people who are living in the North and, you know, constantly been told, oh, if you want to be actors, you have to learn to speak RP.
Yeah.
And Colin said at the casting of Christopher Eccleston, I hope he gets to keep the accent because I wasn't allowed. Because he's from Manchester. Now, he didn't mean in Doctor Who. He meant generally. When he came down in the 70s and became an actor, he was told, you have to get rid of the Mancunian accent.
Yeah, mother.
Tom had to get rid of the Liverpool accent.
Yes, but he did that at a very early age.
So, yeah. And Liz to a certain extent as well. Although with Liz Sladen, it does creep through sometimes.
She was actually a bit naughty. Barry Letts didn't want her to murder that cup of tea because it was cruel and it would encourage aberrant behaviour. But no, she was throwing things like, get off.
Yes.
And they almost cut them.
Yeah.
Because Terence Dix doesn't like colonialism except when it's done by the British Empire.
Yeah.
See, I knew nothing about Christopher Eccleston. I didn't even know who he was.
You'd seen him in films, though.
No, I knew that. Is he in 28 Days?
Yeah. Mm.
that's the only thing I'd ever seen him in, and like I couldn't even remember him from that. So
no,
for me,
I'm the same.
So, for me, it was just a new person coming in playing the Doctor, which I kind of liked that I didn't know anything about him. So I was completely fine with whatever they went with.
Yeah,
Doctor Who was coming back for a year or two or whatever.
Yeah.
On the topic of conventions, which you mentioned earlier, Todd.
Yes.
I was running the day events at the time, the mini conventions,
and
so we decided it was a wonderful idea if we had a day looking at the work of Christopher Eccleston and Billy Piper. Yeah!
How'd that go?
So, Eccleston had done an episode of The League of Gentlemen, which we couldn't show in mixed company because it's The League of
Gentlemen.
Yeah. So we showed The Second Coming.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good choice.
But in terms of Billy, Billy was very new to acting at this point. She'd done The Canterbury Tales, but it hadn't been released in Australia yet because it was on the strength of The Canterbury Tales she gets cast here. So we played a Victoria Wood as seen on TV special where Billy's in it for 30 seconds.
You could have played one of her music videos.
Actually, I think we did play Because We Want To and Honey to the Bee, and then I was told to stop.
And not Day on Day and Night?
Yeah. All of the day. That's all I can sing.
See,
I've still
got those CDs.
I actually like that song.
I love her music,
yes,
to be honest.
Dear listeners, I have CDs. They are physical objects.
No, I've never heard of them. So what do we think of Billy? I do remember at the time there was a sort of negative fan reaction because
before
she's a pop star.
Before the viewing, yeah. Oh, well, it was spectacularly implosive, wasn't it? Much like everything that was coming out. I think the interesting thing about this period of Doctor Who is that it is entirely interwebbed with fandom and that the voice of the fan is absolutely entrenched in and interwoven with what we're seeing on screen. And it wasn't like that before. We were just saying that nothing was new. The casting of regional, well, we've seen all this in 87.
Yeah. I think, though, that this season is unique, this series is unique, because it's more or less in the can before there's any fan reaction. And it is very, very conscious of not putting off new viewers. You know, it doesn't want to be too science fiction-y. And
but
it wasn't until... Well, not but
even
we've had
in
years
the
of Sayward and stuff. Do you know
what
I mean?
I sort of pretend that didn't happen.
But I agree with you, Nathan, and that's why Christopher Eccleston's interpretation of the Doctor is unique, because it's the only one in the history of the show where his entire performance, there's no feedback from the public. He, even William Hartnell initially, yes, he's doing what he's doing, but then he'd have to be talking to his grandchildren, getting, you know, and other people saying things, you know, whereas here it's unique. Christopher has to make decisions based on what he's seeing in daily rushes and that sort of thing on the performance. And I think you can see that as he goes through in terms of the comic, perhaps, aspects of it or how intense he is. And it's completely unique. I mean, every other Doctor that comes after him measures themselves against him, and they do more than one season, so they get to have time to reflect and change things. And
I think Capaldi's a great example of that, actually, more than perhaps anyone else.
In terms of Billy, the papers were talking about it being Billy Piper before Russell T. Davies and Julie Gardner spoke to Billy Piper. Because she was a very successful pop star who never had a big scandal the way a lot of successful pop stars do. At the time, she had a successful marriage to a very successful person. Now, that broke down over the course of this filming, partially due to them being separated and apart from each other. But, you know, also they've commented in later years that it was something with a sort of finite lifespan on it.
Yeah.
And so this successful pop star then moves into acting, and she's got all the tabloids behind her. And I just think that's interesting that they were saying that she was the new Doctor Who companion before the production team had even spoken to her. And also auditioned, of course, as we know now, was Georgia Moffat, the daughter of Peter Davison. And she was apparently very successful.
Stephen Moffat, the daughter of Peter Davison and Stephen Moffat.
That's right. I also recall
she was the Pierce Brosnan of the house, wasn't she?
I also recall, and I don't know if she was joking or not, but India Fisher said she put her name in. I don't know if she got an audition.
I can't remember.
The main thing I remember about India Fisher is she wanted us to find a surfer husband, and she kept screaming at us, "It's all very well you gays liking me, but for God's sake, I'm in Sydney and I need a surfer husband."
I need servicing.
As Kenneth Williams used to say.
I was really excited by Billy Piper's casting.
Me too.
Like, there were aspects of fandom that were not.
Yeah.
and very vocal about it. How can a pop star possibly do this? But I kind of looked at it like, you know, if you're doing pop videos, you are acting like in those.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just kind of put it down to things like, you know, when you see comics, comedians often make really good dramatic actors.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went, you know, there's nothing to say that she's not going to, you know, excel. And of course,
she does.
She's fantastic.
Yeah. She knocks it out of the park.
How did Russell know? That was the thing.
But wasn't she repositioning herself as an actor? Because after her pop career had sort of fizzled, then didn't she go away and do courses and stuff? And was
she's very clever, and thus was
coming back, reinventing her career as an actress.
Yes, absolutely. And what's interesting is around the same time, Britney Spears attempted to do the same thing.
How did that go?
Well, she's got residency at Vegas, so, you know, she went back to the singing and that was fine. But Billie was very savvy in that the roles she pursued. Now, okay, this is a leading role, but the series is not called Rose. The series is called Doctor Who. Now, arguably with the new series, they do make it into co-leads. But unlike a lot of American singers who try and get into acting and they're like, I'm going to headline my own movie straight off the bat, Billie Piper was prepared for, no, I'll take smaller roles and I'll take supporting roles. I'll do the Canterbury Tales. Oh my God, I've got Doctor Who. Billie Piper didn't seem to push herself out there as, no, 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 I must be front and center. Yeah. So I think what you're saying, Todd, is right. She learned her craft, and that's possibly why she was more successful than other singers turned actors.
Right.
Yeah. And
plus she's British.
Yeah.
It's a different ethos because the acting industry is different there.
So we've talked about the lead up to the show, but can we talk about the show itself?
We better start talking about that. Yeah.
So I think the first most striking thing about it is how much it borrows Pertwee's iconography. So the opening titles are a version of Pertwee's original opening titles with a red sort of swirly thing and the use of Futura, the font.
Yes.
Yeah. And what he does, what Russell does, is creates a large regular cast. And that's always a problem with Doctor Who, particularly, I think, in a modern TV environment, that you essentially have two leads and everyone else is new every week. You just have a guest cast. Mm-hmm. And I think that's hard to do. And I don't think it happens all that much in TV. And so Russell creates a sort of extended cast of characters. So can we talk about them?
Jackie and Mickey.
Yeah. So Jackie, Todd.
Camille Kudry is just the bee's knees. I will have to say that she is my favourite character in those first 2 years of the show.
Yeah.
I just adore her, and the way she pitches all the jokes throughout the episode, but she cares for her daughter. I believe I haven't read it yet, the new novelisation makes Jackie a bit more bitchy perhaps and not as good relationship with Rose. I don't know. But I love the fact that in this she's not unlikable. And she's so warm, and but she's so real, and I just love her. I can't say, you know.
She strikes me as someone who would never have been in Doctor Who before, like someone's mum. Do you know what I mean? Doctor Who's previous attempts to do this give us Meg Seeley, I think.
You know, that's so true.
Yeah. So, you know, like a sort of normal working class person.
Make it all sick. It's generally where we've gone with mother characters.
And I guess the setting as well is where we last left off proper Doctor Who with Survival, where we're in a council estate in London. And so we're in contemporary London and we have this character who could easily have been sort of from EastEnders or something with great comic timing. And she's also someone who would never have watched Doctor Who in a million years. Yeah. And so when she talks about what's going on, she talks like one of the not we. She talks like a person at home who's just watching this with all her talk of planet Earth and spacemen and stuff like that. She doesn't use the vocabulary.
But she does represent everybody else's mum, doesn't she? The fan's mum. Mm. This was really made about Russell as a young person, as a lady person.
Yeah, well, Russell and Rose share the same first name, just about, don't they? Yeah. I think that's deliberate. Yeah. And he'd used the name Tyler before. Vince, who was basically Russell in Queer as Folk, his last name's Tyler.
There are Tyler characters in Damaged Goods.
Bob and Rose.
Yes. Yeah.
I think the only show he made that didn't have a Tyler was Mine All Mine, which had a character called Rose.
Oh, okay. Well, you think, yeah. Like, Rose is very definitely Russell. In the very first kind of Doctor Who annual or whatever the equivalent to that was that year, Rose's birthday is given as 27th of April, which is the same day as Russell's and mine, as it happens, if you want to take a look at my Amazon wish list. So she's very definitely him in the show, I think. And I think that when he was a kid and he was watching Doctor Who, he always imagined he was Joe or he was Sarah.
No, exactly. People often ask me why I cosplay as Doctor Who girls sometimes, to the point that one of the actresses I cosplayed at thought I was taking the mick out of her. But it's more that, yeah.
Who?
Oh, no. I won't say. I won't say. It's a short list. I've only done like 3 or 4.
Okay.
But
Eileen Way.
Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to say... Exactly. The greatest piece of miscasting is not bringing Eileen Way back as Jackie Tyler.
Well, I'm thinking that I'll get Brendan to tell me off mic and then I'll sneak into the show.
Yeah. I'll tell you now. It was Daphne Ashbrook. And, you know,
I think we've said that on the podcast before.
I think it's because of a different mentality.
And you were doing it in a wheelchair. I mean, it was really offensive. So many levels.
Calling everyone Julian. As a kid, I realize often you're not looking to be the Doctor. You don't want to be the Doctor because you can't imagine being the Doctor because the Doctor's this alien, but you can imagine being the human.
Yeah. I think nice people want to be the companions and the rest of us wanted to be the Doctors. I always did Doctor. Companion who? No idea.
No, I wanted to be, always wanted to be a companion, but I had the ability to regenerate.
Also, you're River Song. Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves. You're Romana. You're Romana, darling.
Romana, darling.
Romana, darling. I suppose it's a bit like the Rick and Morty fans who think they're Rick.
Yeah, yeah. But they're not. They're Jerry.
They're Jerry. Camille gives the show what it needs, and it's something we talked about with the early Tom Baker era, because you've just had the UNIT era, so every time you go back to Earth, you don't have to introduce a whole bunch of new characters. You introduce half a new cast because you've got the UNIT people. Whereas I think we particularly talked about it in Hand of Fear, the Doctor and Sarah come back to Earth and it doesn't feel real because we've got nothing to latch onto. Yeah.
Well, it is the Hand of Fear, though.
It is also it's Bob Baker and Dave Martin. Why didn't they bring them back for the new series? Yeah. They were both alive when it started. Any thoughts on that, Todd?
No comment.
But yeah, having Jackie and Mickey, it gives us that grounding and it gives us that basis and it gives us the alternative Rose could be living.
Yeah.
Because when we introduce companions in the old series, very often the alternative to being with the Doctor is being killed.
Yeah.
You know, the Doctor saves them. Whereas Rose's alternative here isn't dying, it's just living a boring, mundane life. And it raises the question, is that better? Is that worse than the threat of death?
I think, too, that there is a sense here, and the idea that the companion's an audience surrogate or an audience identification figure isn't necessarily right. But here it's a story where the Doctor could land and take any one of the members of the audience off with him. You know, she's from our world. She lives a fairly ordinary life.
Could have been Camille. Liner notes, Pertwee and a penny. Really, if you want old home values.
And while we're on the regular cast, what about Mickey?
Muggsy.
Well, okay. So I really loathed him in this episode when I first saw it. I loathed his acting. Richard's nodding his head, okay? And I hated the performance. The character was just set up to be this horrible cipher that you just thought he was a buffoon. And the fact that Rose couldn't even tell the difference between a plastic replica and the real thing in the car just sort of, I think, undermined the character. That's my opinion.
No, I think there's a lot to be said for that.
And I think I feel it's a misstep or a mistake. Having watched this only a few days ago, you know, there's a bit of the Mickey that we know at the beginning, but you don't know him at the beginning. Like, there's just a little bit there. You don't get enough of a sense of him before they turn him into just the way he goes, oh, don't go, Rose, the way he acts, that sort of thing. It still annoys me. But what I gathered out of this particular viewing was actually how fantastic he is as evil Mickey, knowing the Mickey that he becomes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that performance with all the plastic and everything like that, he is absolutely nailing it at that point.
He's Simon Cowell, really.
But I really, really enjoyed that this time. But I do think there are problems with his character through this that just set him up for failure and not really liking him.
He's so emasculated, which I think is the unfair thing. As Peter Davison would say, what's in for the boys?
And just, you know, the fact that he is so, I don't know, weak and sort of like scared, and it's like really like, and so they have to do a lot of, I don't know, rewriting or backpedaling or in future episodes to try and get that character back. And for me, it takes quite a few episodes, even later in the season when he's talking about that Delaney girl, like he's still spoilers, like a whinging, whining thing at points. It's like, come on, I want more, because he is a good actor. And by the end, you know, you're wanting him to be there. So
I have to say that I think there probably is a deliberate arc in this first recording block. Because
is it though? Because Todd, weren't you saying that he wasn't going to be in subsequent episodes?
He was always going to be in the first three, apparently. Yeah, he was
first three.
The first three recorded. So this, Aliens of London and World War III. Is that right, Brendan?
That's correct. So the last we were officially going to see of him was when the Doctor and Rose go off at the end of World War III, and he's left sitting on the bins looking up at the sky waiting for her to come back.
It's all about the bin.
But he's better in those episodes. They do stuff with his character where you kind of think, okay, you know, this is better. Don't want to jump ahead because you'll discuss that later on. But maybe it's the director.
I think it's partly the director, and I think there's a reason Keith Boak doesn't come back after these episodes.
He does
direct very broadly. And, you know, we do have that ridiculous Mickey Orton makeup job that Rose seems not to notice, you know.
It's not the director's fault necessarily that went.
Possibly not. But it's difficult to find stuff up about this time, because it's only now, 13 years later, that the production team and actors are talking about the difficulties they faced on the job.
That's
because
true.
It was so tumultuous. In terms of Noel, his star was on the rise because he was in Alvida Zane Pett. And his scenes for Rose were mostly recorded in 5 days. They had to fly him back from Thailand, where Alvida Zane Pett was being shot, shoot for 5 days, and then the Monday after that, so he shot Monday to Friday, the Monday after that, he actually had the funeral of Pat Roach, who was an actor in Alvida Zane Pett, who had passed away suddenly during the shoot. So I don't know if that feeds into Noel's performance at all, because he is so much better in the next time he appears, and then he keeps getting better throughout. But I think it's also the fact that no one really knew what they were doing. There's a great interview with Phil Collinson who explains that 2 weeks into the shoot they were 3 weeks behind in terms of what they were meant to be shooting. And that's where Susie Liggett came on board as a production unit manager, who later became producer. So yeah, it was a tumultuous production, but I think you can, as broad as Mickey is played in this story, you can begin to see the seed of the braver character he will become. Something I still find is very odd is there's an implication that he soils himself in the Nestine lair. When Rose finds him, she says, oh, you're stinking. And originally I thought, oh, that's the bin. But at the end of the episode where they're stumbling out, he's kind of walking bow-legged.
He's like Ruprecht the monkey boy at that point. It's really unfortunate. And I do think, I do want to blame Keith Boak. Can I just do that? I think he's not a very good director.
I think you
director.
Were the only one to
no.
get blamed.
No,
Keith
I don't
Boak
think
on
I was.
Shoot.
And we'll get more of that later, because some of the very earliest scenes shot were in like World War III, and they're astonishingly poor. Mm. But they do walk back from that stuff almost immediately. So the bright saturated colours in Rose's flat, all of that sort of hyper-real kind of children's TV look that he brings to it. Mm. Now, there are things about it that I like enormously, things like the montage at the very beginning, you know, the way that we get the story of Rose's life told in a way that would just never, ever have been possible in the original show. And even, you know, people complained about the bin and the burping bin and stuff like that, but I think that's tremendously good. And, you know,
do you really?
Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily well realized, but I think it's a really good idea. And I certainly remember walking down the street for weeks afterwards feeling tentative about touching the tops of any bins, and I certainly knew that there were 10-year-olds that were feeling the same way.
Dear listener, can you feel the grimace on Todd's face at this point?
It was Russell's idea.
Bin is just pathetic. I'm sorry.
But it's that kind of thing. You know, it's the same thing, and I think Russell is doing it quite deliberately, and he will do it with the farting aliens as well.
Don't get me started.
Is that he's doing stuff hasn't been on Doctor Who before, and he's doing things that don't sit well with finally ending up as TARDIS Wikia pages. Do you know what I mean? There was a whole heap of people who didn't like The Last Jedi because it contradicted some of their favourite Wikipedia articles. And I think that Russell, by doing that sort of stuff and the burp joke, which occurs no less than 3 times in Return of the Jedi, is a sort of signifier that this is not just for people who have all of Peter Haining's, you know, coffee table books on their shelves, but it is for the kids at home and for the adults as well. And it's a sign that we're not going to be taking this show that seriously.
Regarding the bin, I do wonder if that was a little bit of a tribute to the dear departed Craig Hinton's novel Synthespians, which was a BBC book which preceded the new series.
Which dealt with a TV broadcaster in deep space, but all the actors are autons. But also various other plastic things come to life, including in a deleted scene, a murderous phallus, shall we say.
Oh,
and, you know, Rose gets that line later, you know, the phone lines, this, that, the breast implants.
I have to say that when I learned that the first episode was going to be about autons and that they were shooting in a street outside a bridal shop, and I sort of suddenly realised there'd be autons in bridal gowns, I was so incredibly excited because they're all wearing sort of really terrible 70s clothes in Spearhead from Space, but having them in sort of activewear and bridal outfits. And in fact, if you read the script book for season one is published, and Russell writes the autons, and they're not directed this way at all, of course, because Keith. He writes the autons as being very elegant and well-dressed, and that's how they carry themselves.
Yeah, one thing Russell was particularly unhappy with was the sort of very, very jerky robotic motion, because he didn't want people to think they were robots. He wanted people to think they were solid plastic and to move sort of slowly in the way the original series autons did. But, you know, I'm not going to harp on it, Keith, because of that, because that is the first thought you would go to, that these are robots, you know. And at this point, communication was difficult.
It is how the original autons moved. Maybe Keith is more of an under-fan than anyone had realised.
But they're not actually called autons, are they, at any point?
No.
The only mentioned is the nesting consciousness.
They're credited as autons. I think it's autons created by Robert Holmes in the closing credits. So
But, yeah, I suppose they didn't want to introduce too many
Space words.
Like, we've already got Sonic Screwdriver, TARDIS, Nestine, Shadow Proclamation.
It's one of the biggest strengths of this script is that he's not giving us, like, the 1996 telemovie in the first minute, you know, Time Lords, Master, Skyro, Daleks, Regeneration, you know, it's not a list of things like that. And it's, as I've said before, it's not aimed at the fans. You know, you want the general public to come in, and I just think that's the right approach.
Yeah,
it's funny you should say that, though, because Lorraine Hegarty and Jane Tranter, who were the BBC controllers who were really behind this project, when Russell turned in the first script, one of them said, "Where's the Master?" and one of them said, "Where's the Daleks?" You know, we need a big draw in this book. And it was actually Julie Gardner who went into bat and said, no, he's the last of the Time Lords now, so we don't have to explain Gallifrey or anything like that. He's the last of his kind, so there's no danger of people running around in silly hats. And as for the Daleks, they're going to be halfway through to get bums on seats again.
Yeah.
And everyone was happy. Something I didn't mention earlier is that Michael Grade almost killed it again.
Really?
What?
So
he just does that in his sleep at this point. It's a reflex. He stumps his toe and cancels.
Now, that makes that internet pic of scowling Russell and scowling Steve at Michael Grade at a book signing all the more relevant, doesn't it?
So, while it was in pre-production, Michael Grade had been reappointed as BBC One controller.
And Valiant.
And so he appointed a new Director General, Mark Thompson. Now, first of all, Michael Grade had been asked, you know, what do you think about Doctor Who coming back? Because, of course, you cancelled it in the 80s. And his response was very diplomatic in that, you know, pretty much I trust the people working at the BBC. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in charge here. I am not directly responsible for commissioning programs. Doctor Who can come back so long as I don't have to watch it.
Ooh.
However,
oh, that wasn't very supportive.
No.
No.
However, he did appoint a new Director General, Mark Thompson. And Mark Thompson was concerned, is there actually audience demand for Doctor Who? And the production team had commissioned a single report about audience demand with a very low appreciation for whether Doctor Who should come back. Not people saying it shouldn't. They don't really care. Mm. So what Jane Tranter did when he asked, is there any audience report? She said, no, we haven't done one. And Julie Gardner then said, and, you know, we've sunk so much money into this that if we give it up, we're going to lose twice as much as if we carry on.
I love these women.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Reading, you know, reading this Doctor Who, The Complete History, which gives, I'm not sponsored, which gives a great rundown. There are so many women involved in bringing back Doctor Who. It feels like, in terms of the production side, the only men involved are Russell T Davies and Mal Young, and latterly Phil Collinson, and you've got Julie Gardner, you've got Lorraine Heggersey, you've got Jane Tranter, and you have other senior women at the BBC as well, who are all involved in bringing it back. And it seems to be half they want to bring back Doctor Who, and half they want to work with Russell T Davies. Mm-hmm. And those two desires seem intertwined, and you know, Russell then has this 5-year journey of bringing Doctor Who back to the screen.
What I adore about this, as opposed to the 1996 telly movie, which gets it so wrong, is the fact that obviously we come in with Rose's eyes, and the Doctor's introduced several minutes into the actual sequence, and you've had the opening credits where there's a police box, and you see a little, the first time you see the Doctor, then in the background after that explosion, you see a little bit of a police box. Then the Doctor goes away and comes back again, and they have that the second time, and then they have their walk, and then you see the police box in full, and he goes to the police box with the key, right? She walks away and you hear a noise and then it's gone. Then he's away again and she does her investigation. So you know a bit more about the Doctor. So you're learning a little bit more about the Doctor, like these little tidbits. You're not trying to overwhelm the audience. And then Plastic Mickey goes insane, and then you've got the full police box. He goes in, right? And as a classic series fan, like, you're wanting her to go in to see what it is. She goes in and you don't see it, and you're going, oh my goodness, you don't see inside. And like, you know, I assume for a new audience, it's like, well, what is this? And she goes around it, and then you go in and see it, right? And the whole thing, like, and that's 27 minutes into the episode.
Yes.
Which is, you know, it's not like
we open in the TARDIS.
That's right. What the hell is this? And I just think that's absolutely brilliant. But then it moves and he talks about it being alien and TARDIS. You just get a little bit of information. You don't get overload dump. And it's moved to a different location, but you still don't see it appear, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end, of course, they get out of the exploding nesting area. Mm. Do we see it land then? I can't remember. We see it land for the first time, but she still hasn't seen it take off or land.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode, obviously, you know, he disappears and she sees it disappear and reappear. And it just struck me, like, how many Doctor Who companions in the history of the show, they meet the Doctor, right? And then they go into the TARDIS. But have they actually seen the TARDIS appear or disappear at this point? They're always inside the TARDIS. They don't actually see that dematerialization. And to me, it's often the last thing they see in their time with the Doctor is actually they finally see the dematerialized TARDIS at the end of their run.
Yes.
Never.
Yes, that's true.
And I only just thought that's about true. This, like, when I was watching it, I'm going, how many actually see that? They just meet the Doctor and do you know what I'm saying?
Finally see it disappear when it leaves without him.
When they're gone.
Yeah.
I just got chills, like, thinking about that.
God, that's brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, there obviously are some that have, but... Yeah.
But also, as you say, because Rose is now seeing it for the first time, we're seeing it as well. Because we do see it leave the nesting thing, but as well, explosions are going on. Yeah. Mike Tucker is back doing models, by the way. But because there's explosions going on, it's not until Rose watches it go and the Doctor goes off for a few seconds and has 57 box sets at Big Finish
Is that coming soon?
That's coming soon.
He's only said it once. Just let's not startle him.
But yeah, Rose then sees it come back at the same time we do, and then we find out it travels in time.
Yes.
That gorgeous last line.
Yes. But it's just brilliant. I just think it's just brilliant how there's little bits all the way through, enough for classic series fans to be going, ooh, but the public not to be overwhelmed. And I just think it gets it so right in this, you know?
I also think it gets Rose's arc right in a way that the telemovie doesn't. So we get to see how it might have played out if she'd decided not to go with the doctor, because for a second she doesn't. And then she's instantly so dejected, like Billy sells it completely, and she's going back to her life of looking after her mother and looking after Mickey and just sort of generally being underappreciated and things like that. And then she gets this spectacular second chance. And it's wonderful.
Yes, yeah.
It really is.
Now, Richard, something you said earlier before we started recording, this story is kind of remixed elements of what we've seen before. So why do you think it works in a way that the telemovie, which was also remixed elements, doesn't?
Okay, apart from the fact that you can't just make a melange or a trifle, a mere foolish thing, of rebooted elements. I think it just works because it has a linear plot, it has consistency, it has expert, and I think this should be at the top of the list, expert characterization and casting.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the tenure of this of us today is maybe the direction isn't that great. I thought it was really pacey and surprising and fun and terrific, and reminded me actually of Sylvester's motorcycle stunts in his last stories, because it felt that sort of thing, but done with, if you can see the evident cash. It feels incredibly nostalgic, but oddly enough, for a time, maybe only 7 years before it was broadcast, it feels like it's nostalgic for the early Blair years, that where we are politically, and, you know, because this is my shtick with FTE, but politically we're already looking back, not just as the show to the lovely golden times of when, you know, the country was blacked out and people were only working 3-day weeks, but still wasn't it all so much better with Hover's bread ads and all the rest of it. But there's also just for that recent hope, and maybe it's not too late, and maybe we just need to look at who we are and what we do so well. And I think really the impetus for the show and why it picked up, the timing was perfect. People were wanting, well, just feeling that we still have a little bit of hope and we still have some impetus and things can be done. But it's still in the way that Britain is, even at its most forward thinking, it's still conservative in that it always looks to the past.
It is that London thing. It's so London, this first episode. You've got the London Eye, you've got London buses, you've got Westminster Bridge. And
it was the original title, Fear of a Welsh Planet, wasn't it?
But it's also running. Queer as Folk, which Murray Gold also did the music for, has so much running. Like, and there's a theme to it. You know, whenever the characters are running from place to place, there's a theme to it. And it's the first word that the Doctor says. And they spend the entire episode running. And there's something so breathless and exciting. And they're running through recognizable places. They're not running through a sleepy English village. They're not running down a cardboard corridor. They're running down Westminster Bridge with London landmarks in the background. London will become such a part of it. It is something, you know, Britain is the most hip and interesting place in the world as far as Doctor Who is concerned, or London itself is. And I think that that's, you know, a historical attitude that they're looking back on too.
I think they were very much seeing that Britain had not gone in the way they'd hoped, and Gordon Brown casting his very thin and pallid shadow. No one had confidence in him, and yet looking back now, he looked actually like a man with, if not vision, he certainly was sturdy. He was the John Major of his times and offered more. But this was not a Britain that would have talked about Brexit.
No.
No.
This is not a story that would have talked about throwing everything away. This was a story about what have we done in the past that was at its best and how we can use that to move on.
It's also extraordinary how this revival led to other revivals or talk of other revivals. So it did lead to a revival of The Tomorrow People as an American co-production. It almost led to a revival of Sapphire and Steel.
That was
pitched. And this is still in development. There is a revival of The Avengers in development.
that's been talked about since 2005, from the director of Iron Man 3, which is a very, very stylish and very Avengers-ish movie.
And set in the 60s.
Well, you would want to hope so. Mm. But what is very interesting is that the time tunnel opening sequence, of course, is terribly nostalgic for Doctor Who in the 70s. The other idea was an Avengers-style opening sequence with symbols and faces and what have you. But somewhere out there, there's sort of an intermediate phase of the time tunnel with Eccleston's face in it. The footage has never been released.
Love to see but that. Is he Gurney?
It was created. I don't know. It's never been winks. Released. And that's the thing. This episode is shrouded still in so much mystery because we don't have the deleted scenes. They've never appeared on any DVD or Blu-ray edition, despite the fact they do exist.
Mm.
And also, Eccleston, you know, has recently commented about directors right from the beginning not taking care of their supporting artistes.
Mm, crashing sofas.
Yeah, well, that's my theory, right? Mm. There was, as part of the Hendrix explosion,
yes.
There was, as part of the Hendrix explosion, a burning sofa that was meant to fall onto the street, and it was shot. And the official line is that the visual effects supervisor, Dave Houghton, wasn't happy with it. And so they composited in an explosion later. But to me, it's like, that still doesn't explain why you get rid of the debris crashing down. And I just wonder if, from Eccleston's perspective, there wasn't due care taken in a dangerous stunt against extras. And if Bowick kind of went, oh, you know, we're behind schedule, we're just going to get on with it. Mm. That could have easily annoyed Eccleston, who he takes pride in. Whether you're the extra or whether you're the star, you're important to this production. Mm. And, you know, he attributes that to his working class roots. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's me reading between the lines. That's my thing, what I do. But the fact that this year of Doctor Who is still shrouded in so much secrecy, it kind of mirrors what we're getting now in that Chris Chibnall and his team are being very careful to release very little information about their production. And Russell T. Davies was a master at releasing information, but it'd take you a few minutes to realise actually you didn't really know much at all.
There was a great little piece that I think Dan Hogarth put together, episodes completely tied together with taxis standing on streets and people outside supermarkets and bin liners and such like, yeah.
I remember the first picture of Christopher Eccleston that escaped from the set was from the end of World War III when he's walking down a street, and judging from the position and whatnot, it's the bit where he's telling Rose that Harriet Jones will bring in a golden age for Britain. Because there was a photo of Penelope Wilton, like, shouting to people, and Eccleston just wandering through the background, his mouth open. But that, for ages, aside from the official publicity, that was the only shot we have him in action. And people kept compositing it onto DVD covers.
I was astounded at one of those corner window TVAM interviews that was loudly touted as, you know, the costume being revealed. No, it's not. He's just on his civvies. He's just walking off the street.
Where's the scarf? Where's the stick of celery?
And the jaw-droppingness that, is that the costume? No. So how they reveal these things is very important. It was done poorly, and
I'm glad it's not a costume. It's not a costume.
No.
It's not what the 80s became, you know? Yeah. He could be wearing it anywhere, which is exactly right. So this production just ticks so many boxes
correctly,
you know, and it feeds old series fans. It feeds those people who are slightly familiar with the show back in the 70s, like with the Autons, they may remember it. It's ticking for new people to come in, making it very easy. There's just so many different areas that they are managing to hit. And it also, you know, sends up the fans with the whole, you know, one of your nutters has arrived. Oh, it's a she, you know, a little nod to, a nod to us where it's a fun thing that if you know Doctor Who fandom, you know.
Yeah.
It's little things like that which are little icing on the cake, I think, in terms of for some of us.
Yeah, and with Clive sort of being a bit comedic and a bit fannish, when Rose leaves him, in the original script anyway, she doesn't just go straight back out to Mickey. We actually see her walk out of the shed and Carolyn's there wheeling along a load of bricks because Clive never does anything around the house. And they just have this moment where Rose says, I'm sorry, and Carolyn says, yeah, I know.
But the thing with Clive is, and with the whole script, as much as there is comedy and action and that sort of thing, there is one other element in this, in the fact that Clive dies, and yeah. Russell manages to introduce the fact that there is danger and there is death there, and yeah. it's something that is real and there are consequences.
Listener, we're getting ready to run very, very slowly into the TARDIS so that Christopher Eccleston can whisk us away to the year 5.5/Apple/26. So do come back next week for the end of the world. In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find over 130 episodes covering our flight through the entirety of the classic series. We're also Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, you can find our commentary podcasts on literally hundreds of James Bond films. That's bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter.
Including the 57 versions of Casino Royale.
Yeah, and counting. So until next time, may you have an astonishingly successful night next Saturday and wake up on Sunday morning to discover that you're now the biggest thing on television.
In a red hoodie, yes.
Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good then.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Richard Stone, and Gay Games grappling champion Brendan Jones. He got the bronze. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Fear of a Welsh Planet, was recorded on the 27th of May 2018 and released on the 26th of August. Here at FTE, we'd like to congratulate friend of the podcast Pete McTighe for his gig as a writer on Series 11 of Doctor Who, and to tell him that we look forward to seeing a remake of The Massacre in the near future.
Rick Mile, was it?
Rick Mile. Mm-hmm.
Would have been good.
But Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant. That's right. Was offered the role and turned it down, and has said in the dishwasher.
No, that's the dog. I can't.
It's Ping Cho.
Okay, look, it's fine.
It's the memory of Ping Cho.
We get police cars and helicopters at night.
That's all.
Drugging.
So what we were with
Hugh Grant.
Beautiful. Yeah, go. We'll start with Hugh Grant. Yeah. Just give it a say.
It's all you, darling.
So, yeah.
I need to go to the toilet.
We'll do it.
Yeah, do it now.
Yeah.
I'll leave it on.
Leave it on.
Fine.
In fact, take it in with you.
It can't be any worse.
Great.
Got the burping.
Any noises you now hear on this podcast are not me, people.
Tag.
Well, none of us had even thought of that, so well done.
Tag. Yeah, I think that's the title. Yeah. You're so mature.
I'm 35 in October.
Same age as
me,
Barbara, as Jackie Hill.
She was actually Bill.
Did you see those photos of Jackie Hill? Yes. I put one through Colorize Bot. It did a very good job. There's a Twitter account called Colorize Bot. And it uses algorithms.
Still rude.
It uses algorithms.
It colorizes the entire lower area. Just short
for colonic colorization.
Tag. Actually, when are we doing the old podcast?
Let's redo.
When are we doing? When are we doing The Massacre 2? Huguenot Boogaloo.
Oh, I'm up for that.
Huguenot Boogaloo.
Huguenot Boogaloo.